Hello, and welcome to the Metro West Daily News Podcast. I'm Megan Kelly, digital editor, and with me today are reporters Brad Avery.
Hello.
And Bill Shaner.
Hey there.
Also with us today is our editor-in-chief, Richard Lodge, who recently announced he would be taking a job as managing editor of the Daily News in Newburyport.
Hello.
So Richard has been with us here at the Metro West Daily News since 2001. Before that, from 93 to 2001, he was editor-in-chief in the Northwest Unit of the Community Newspaper Company in Concord, which used to be our old name before we became Gatehouse, and has worked at the Lowell Sun and other newspapers around New England. He's been a photographer, reporter, and editor, and was awarded the Yankee Quill Award given by the Academy of New England Journalists in 2014 to honor excellence in community journalism. And his last day here is Friday. So, Richard, thank you for sitting down with us today. And I was just chit-chatting with Bill before this and said, as I recall, your first week on the job here at Metro West was the week of 9/11. So what was that like?
Yeah, I was actually, it was a little over a week after I started. And so it was obviously a shocking international event. But being here in a place where I had just gotten to know the staff, still learning some names, still finding my way around, and then I walked in one morning, Joe Dwinell, who was the managing editor here at the time, was the first guy in the morning most days. So Joe was here, I walked in, he's standing in the middle of the newsroom and looking at the two TVs we had up over the news desk, and his his mouth is open, the first plane had already hit one of the World Trade Tower buildings, and as we're standing there, the second one hits, and from there it was just scrambling to figure out what was happening, scrambling to figure out what we could get in. We actually had a late edition of the paper that day, so it was quite the news event to cover for a small daily newspaper. I mean, within an hour, much of the staff had come in. Everybody was just, once they heard, they came in and said, what can I do? Who should I call? So it was a great, great team effort, and it was a good experience for a newsroom to come together on something like that, even though obviously it was a real tragedy.
Well, and be a national, international event as it is, it still was very personal to Metro West because there were quite a few people who were on planes, including the contingent from TJX.
Yeah, there were about, I think we found 25 people with either who were residents of Metro West or had real strong connections here, family members here. Or in the case of, I think it was 7 women from TJX. It was a very local story. A local story, I think, for a lot of places in New England, but we certainly found a lot of people who were directly affected by it.
So, kind of switching gears a little bit, in your 15 years that you've been here, what are some changes that you've seen? I mean, beyond the obvious. I mean, we know that staff is smaller and there's the internet to contend now, but what are some other kind of changes you've seen?
I think that the biggest change is it's not just Metro West, but it's sort of the change in technology in newspapers and publishing in general. And the way that people get their news it certainly didn't start changing 15 years ago, but that was early in a period, I think, where we were starting to see what became a major transformation in how people communicate and how they get their news. And that's been probably the biggest challenge. I'm sure it is for the staff. It certainly is for the company as a whole to figure out two things, really: how to continue to put out a good print newspaper, a lot of print newspapers when you include all of the Massachusetts Gatehouse papers, but and also to provide real news on the web, timely, accurate interesting and to engage that very, very large and growing web audience. And that's, again, it's not unique to Metro West. It's every newspaper in any civilized country, you know, is facing the same challenge.
Is there anything you see that you think we need to do more of, or something that we're not doing at all that we need to do to exist on the internet and to survive?
No, I mean, I think if I had that answer, I'd be going into the newspaper consulting business rather than going to another daily newspaper.
Yeah.
I think that just continued aggressive and innovative coverage of trying to figure out, again, what people are interested in, but not pandering to what they're interested in. And I think that's where a lot of media outlets have gone. And I don't think that credible newspaper companies need to go there or should go there, because I think we provide a really important service to communities, and that's to cover the communities, to reflect what's going on here, and to do really accurate, timely reporting on news, not to just do cat videos. You know, I mean, that's a cliche, but, you know, I think when you start, and I think a lot of, all due respect to our media partners in Boston Television, you know, I think a lot of television has gone the route of, we have some video here from Oshkosh and it's exciting and interesting, but I can't tell you how many times I've seen TV videos that are completely irrelevant to our lives. And frankly, where they are taken, where they occur, also is irrelevant, because they're just somewhere. You know, somebody got some surveillance footage, somebody got, you know, whatever, a car going off a cliff, and it's just not relevant. It's entertainment. So I think that what we do is important, and we have to keep doing that important stuff.
It's not just the technology, but also the way articles are written now. There's, with the internet, there's been a much bigger push for more informal writing, more conversational writing. I see even from major publications like Washington Post, you know, I read their news articles now, and they don't read so much as a very firm, you know, they would say, you know, you're writing sort of without voice in a way. You're writing to report. And I see that changing drastically. I mean, how...
Are you asking for permission or forgiveness?
No, I'm just asking, have you, like, noticing this, like, noticing the changes in just the way things are reported?
Sometimes, but I think you have to, I don't think writing has to be stilted, and there's certainly a time when writing should be very conversational, and reporting can be conversational, but it can't be sloppy and it can't be inaccurate. I mean, I think you have to have standards of what you're trying to do in terms of accuracy and timeliness and news value, and then how you write it depends on the circumstances and depends on the audience maybe and depends on the venue. You know, writing a column is different from writing a straight hard news story, and there's a lot of gradations in between. But I think there's a difference between inserting your opinion into a story and writing in a conversational way. Those are very different things. And I think it's when we lose sight of the fact that a reporter is sticking opinion in that we're going down a slippery slope.
So one of the things that the Yankee Quill Award folks had said about you was that you are very committed to pursuing open meeting law violations. Yep. and your interest in that. And, you know, I've definitely noticed that as well working alongside you. But I'm curious if that's always kind of been your main point of interest, or if it's just something that you picked up along the way.
It's not my main point of interest. I think it's an important role that newspaper editors play. And frankly, some people in the community play that role. You know, I would cite Attorney George Harris, who's a Wayland resident and a former selectman in Wayland, who has filed many, many open meeting law complaints against various boards in the town of Wayland. George knows the law. He believes in transparency and openness in town government. He's been in town government. And even if people might occasionally see him as a pest, he is the public's advocate. And he's using a law that's an important law. And I agree with that. And I think newspapers, we use a public records request too. And it's not meant to be a sledgehammer. It's a tool that the law is set up so that media outlets and individuals can get information that we believe we're entitled to and that the public may have a strong interest in. So, yeah, I find the open meeting law is an important thing. And who's going to ask for enforcement of the law if we don't? The occasional resident who's knowledgeable, like George? Yes, but not every town has a person like that. And it's the media's role to police things and to make sure that the doors are open when they should be open and when the law says they should be open. So, yeah, that's important. It's not my life. It's just a tool.
Yeah. I'm wondering, so that got me thinking, I'm wondering if you could maybe speak more broadly about the role, maybe like the societal role that a paper like Metro West Daily News plays in its community, in the way you've seen it in your many years of being the editor
here. Yeah. I think any decent newspaper and its related website now, I guess the way to answer that question is maybe to say, if we closed up right now, closed up shop, and didn't cover anything today, didn't publish anything online, didn't publish a newspaper tomorrow, or the next day, you know, I would throw that into the laps of people and say, well, where are you going to get your news? From the woman next door who saw something and tells you about it? Well, yeah, that's called a conversation, you know, or that's called gossip. You're going to get it on your Facebook page? Well, where's the news and where's the verification of facts and detail and where's the timeliness? I mean, again, on social media, you can pass information and news along, but the veracity of that and the credibility of who's reporting it to you is really hard to figure out sometimes, you know? What's the expression? If your mother says she loves you, get a second source, check on it. I mean, you have to know where the information is coming from. You have to know that it's a credible, reliable reporter of information. And that's what newspapers often do. That's what they should be doing. And so if we disappear, that's a problem, I think, for society as a whole. Because then, you know, we rely on each other for what's true and false and news and not news. And I guess I would ask people to try to look through that lens and figure it out. What would it be like tomorrow?
And so kind of on that topic, mm-hmm. What do you think some of the most pressing issues in this region are facing, that the Metro West region is facing?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's a pressing issue, but I think it's a really interesting issue, and that's the charter vote in Framingham. You know, this is, I think, the fourth time that the town of Framingham has gotten to this point of a serious discussion about whether a new form of government should be put in place, and it's a long process. It's a process that involves lots and lots of people and brings in the voices and the opinions of a lot of people in town and experts in and outside of the town. And I think that's a really important thing that's going on, you know, and that'll be resolved at some point after I'm gone. And I wish the town luck. It's important for a growing area like this. I think two other things that are important for Metro West. One is the influx over the decades, really, of different immigrant groups into this area of this part of the state, and how they how they interact, how they are incorporated into the society out here, how people accept them or don't accept them. And in some cases, yes, there's a strain on public services and town budgets and things like that. But that's called, you know, the evolution of America. And I just think that's, in this political year, on the national level, that's become a real hot point of discussion. And I think it's a really important thing. And, you know, people have to live together and figure out how to make the society work as a really heterogeneous place, and that makes it a better place. So that's an ongoing discussion. And the other thing, I think there are places where people don't make enough money to live comfortably in Metro West, and I think that's sometimes that's not reported on enough, and especially the elderly and new people coming in. There's some towns where if you were to try to buy a house, try to get your kids into what you think is a better school, it's just almost impossible to do it. And that's, again, that's not unique to Metro West, but it's an important issue to be covering.
Are there other, you know, topics you think that could be covered more? Anything else that, just in our communities, that, you know, we hear at the paper sometimes, you know, gloss over, that, you know, either because there might not be a story of the day, but are, you know, ongoing things that need coverage and need reporting?
I think that it's always important to, and I haven't always practiced this, I must say, but I think it's, I worked at a newspaper in Maine with a for an editor who I had a great deal of respect for. And one of the things he used to say is, you know, when you come to work every day, you should take a different route. And I said, what do you mean? Well, you should take a different route, go through a different part of the city, come through another town coming in, or come in a different way. You know, park 5 blocks away and walk and see what you see and see who you talk to. I thought that was an interesting view. So you don't get that kind of narrow, on automatic pilot way of starting your day. And the other thing is, this was in Portland, Maine, which at the time I was there, there were very few minorities living in Portland. And, you know, he said, it's a mainly white newsroom we have. And it's really important that we reach out to people of all races and ethnic groups and backgrounds, and that, you know, we may be sort of a homogenous middle class, college educated bunch of people in the newsroom, but don't be, you know, don't have your blinders on. Realize that there are communities that we need to be covering. It may be hard because they speak different languages. It may be hard because we're not comfortable or not familiar with those groups of people, but the newspaper has a really important role in trying to reflect all of the aspects of a community, all of the people in a city. And we worked very hard to do that. So I think that's, you know, that's something that any newspaper should sort of keep aware of. Don't get in a rut in your coverage because you go to sources and people and topics that are really comfortable to you as a reporter or as an editor. You definitely need to get out of your comfort zone.
I'm interested in, what was your first job? How did you get your start? Talk about that a little bit. Your first job in journalism.
Oh, in journalism. Yeah. You didn't want to hear about me painting the roof of barns out in Indiana.
No, not particularly.
In the middle of the summer. I kind of took the long way getting through college and graduated from BU, and I got a degree in journalism, but you know, I'm not sure that was that relevant in hindsight. But while I was in college, I had the opportunity to do, I really love photography. I'd been doing photography for a long time, and I had the opportunity to do some reporting for a weekly newspaper in the Austin-Brighton area, and also a professor at BU got some kind of a grant to start a newspaper in District 5 of the Boston Public Schools. And this was back in the days, the early days of busing in Boston. And so real division in some of the, and real segregation in a lot of the schools in Boston. So District 5 was the Jeremiah Burke High School and Dorchester, a pretty tough area back then. So I was a photographer and reporter for this monthly newspaper that we produced for a year. And that was a great experience. Very, very different experience for me, I have to say.
Monthly newspaper.
Yeah, it was monthly, yeah. We wrote a lot, and if we had the web today, you know, it would be a totally different thing. But it was a classroom project, and yet we produced, literally had this newspaper printed and distributed for free in District 5. So that was a good learning experience. My first real job was the Marblehead Messenger, which was a weekly in the town of Marblehead. So I was hired as a reporter.
Great.
Straight out of college.
So. Yeah.
You know, a lot of the reporters here were, we skew younger.
I was like that once.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, when you take us on and, you know, you're saying, okay, this person's young, this person's getting started mm-hmm. in this field, in this career, you know, how does that differentiate from, you know, the reporters who have been doing this for years, who have, you know, this has been their lifelong career?
Mm-hmm. Well, first I would put it in context that I think when I started at Marblehead, I was either 22 or 23.
Yeah.
So, again, I was young once, a young reporter. I don't think that, you know, the thing that has changed over the years when it comes to young reporters being hired is the technology comes in. You know, you guys know things and have experienced things and have gotten your news in different ways than Megan or I.
Just want to interject here that I'm not that old.
No, she's not that old. But still.
No, I am older enough.
Old enough that as a kid, she wasn't necessarily playing at a computer keyboard. Maybe she was, but, you know, I was...
I agree with you. I think that, yeah. that I mean, I, we did have a computer, but that was unusual because my dad worked at IBM.
Yeah.
But I think that I might have been the last generation of children that played outside and didn't get their news from the computer and I had Nintendo, but that was it, really.
It wasn't
like it is today. And it wasn't like it was in the 90s either.
Right. So
be lucky you didn't have to choose your MySpace top 8 in middle school. Oof, that was bad.
I didn't even have a MySpace. I think I'm that old.
Anyway, not to get too off track here.
No, but I mean, that's really illustrative of that point, mm-hmm. though, is that, yeah. I mean, when I was in 8th grade, I think maybe we had a modem, you know, and... You guys probably had high-speed internet already when you were in 8th grade.
When I was in 9th grade, I took a typing course. So, and, you know, we had typewriters, and and I was resistant, but my mother was, she said, you need to take driver's ed so you can get a license, and you need to take typing because you'll have to know how to do that when you're an adult and when you're in college. And I'm very glad she pushed me on both of those things. I'm a good driver, and I'm a good typist. So... You know, I guess it is the technology that's different, and that's what younger reporters bring to a newsroom. And it's not just the technology. It's your use of it and how that shapes your view of the world and how you communicate with people and how you find things out and how you what you bring to the job. I mean, we're sitting here doing a podcast. This didn't happen 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know. If anything, we'd be sitting in a radio booth doing a talk show. This is a talk show, but it's done differently. It's accessible differently, and you know that's an evolution right there. So, and you guys brought this in a sense. You know, your generation is you know taking hold of this kind of tool and using it to communicate with people, which I think is great.
So it's no great trade secret that it's tough out there. In that the industry isn't necessarily thriving right now, and I wonder if you have any advice for young journalists, you know, not me or anything, you know, young journalists in abstract on you know, how to make it in this industry and how to cement yourself.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can't buy into the media is dying, excuse me, the media is dying myth. Although I do follow a guy on Twitter whose Twitter handle is "The Media is Dying," he's got a great sense of humor. I guess as evidence, I would point to the fact that I'm about to start a new job after 23 years in this company, as the editor of a daily newspaper in a small community, where the daily newspaper and its website are actually thriving, and needed. And they have room to grow. I think, in terms of reporting, what we do here is you need to keep doing that, and you will keep doing that. You just may be disseminating it differently, as we are now. You know, the print newspaper—that's what's changing, not the fact that reporters are still reporting stories. Or photographers are still taking photos and videos. You know, how we share that information with people, that's what's changing. So the jobs are evolving, but the jobs aren't going away. And the importance of them certainly is even more important today, as there are so many different voices out there and so many different places that people can get information.
Great. Well, I think we can wrap this up. But thank you, Richard. It was great sitting with you and listening to your perspective, and we wish you the best of luck in Newburyport.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. Thanks.
So now we have our regular segment called Around the Keurig, where we talk about things you might chat with your coworkers when you're having your coffee break or waiting in line to get your coffee from your Keurig that might be quite ancient and slow, like ours is.
It sound like a helicopter.
So mine this week is this podcast that I've been listening to for a while, and I also bought the book that he wrote, but John Dickerson, who is on Face the Nation on CBS on Sundays, and he also is on the Slate Political Gab Fest, which is one of my favorite podcasts. He does this podcast called Whistle Stop, and it's about past presidential campaigns, and it's really about the campaigns. It's not so much about presidents in office, but the actual race. And it's really interesting and it's great. And last week's episode was about Betty Ford, who was first lady with when Gerald Ford was president after Nixon was impeached or resigned. So I knew about Betty Ford in terms of the Betty Ford Center because she had struggled with addiction and alcohol abuse in the 70s. But what I didn't know was that she was one of the trailblazers in the breast cancer world, because before then, women who had breast cancer were very kind of, it was kind of shameful. You wouldn't say, "I have breast cancer," because you're saying breast, and that was, you know, a scandal. And she discovered that she had breast cancer. She got treatment, she got a mastectomy, and she was very open and public about it. And that triggered so many other women to go to their doctor and say, "Oh, can I get a mammogram? Can I get checked out?" And all these women started finding out that they too had breast cancer and they were able to get treated for it. So, you know, she sounded like a really funny character. She was really open and, you know, definitely was the 70s. So she kind of knew it was a different world. And she had children who were, I think the youngest was 18. She was still living with her parents in the White House. And she was on this 60 Minutes interview with Morley Safer, who, first of all, asked her this question: "Do you think your husband has ever had an affair?" Which is crazy, and I can't imagine any journalist asking a first lady or potential first lady, "Do you think that your husband has had an affair?" And her answer was pretty funny. It was something like, you know, "He likes to look at the pretty girls, but yeah, I keep him busy." But then she was also asked about what would she do if her daughter Susan was having an affair? And I didn't realize what they meant by affair, but they really meant what if she were having a relationship with a young man and they were having sex and they were not married.
Back then, right. That's an affair.
That's an affair. And so she gave this answer like, "Well, you know, I would tell her that's probably not a good idea, but, you know, she's an adult and that kind of answer, and it was really shocking. And she said stuff too, like she assumed that her children had tried pod and all this other stuff. So she sounded, it was a really interesting episode, and you know, I think that she definitely should be lauded for her coming out with the breast cancer thing and getting so many women to get tested for it. But I also just, she just sounded like a really sassy modern lady at the time who was like, I take no guff, I'm Betty Ford, and sure, more to say for you can ask me that terrible question and I will give you a good answer. So yeah,
it's pretty cool. Great. What's the podcast again?
It's called Whistle Stop.
Whistle Stop.
Yeah.
I've also got a podcast. It's been on for a few years now, and they're in the final season because they can't keep doing this forever, but it's by two New Zealand comedians called The Worst Idea of All Time. Has anyone heard of this
yet? Yes, I've heard of this podcast.
So The Worst Idea of All Time is a brilliant idea for us. For them, they decided a couple years ago that they were going to they decided to do a movie podcast. We're going to watch a movie every week and talk about it. It's going to be the same movie every week. It's going to be Grown Ups 2, starring Adam Sandler and David Spade and Chris Rock. That's an odd
choice.
Kevin James. So they hadn't seen Grown Ups either. They just went straight to Grown Ups 2 and watched it every week. And they initially started, you know, thinking no one was going to listen to this, but they stayed dedicated anyway. And they put a limit and said, okay, we're going to do it for a year. So they did it, the entire thing for a year. By the end of the first season, they had finally caught on, and they eventually had the final episode recorded live in L.A. They watched it on a big screen.
Wow.
And so they did a season two now where they did Sex in the City 2,
okay,
the movie.
Okay.
And then finally they're on their third and final season where they're doing the Zac Efron EDM movie We Are Your Friends. So they broke the sequel chain, but they've been doing this. They're really funny. The names Guy Montgomery and Tim Batt, and they're from New Zealand. And it's the first season, which is the only one I've listened to in full, is fascinating because you really get the sense for their emotional distress as they're going through this. Like, they start off.
Do they watch it every week? And they
watch
talk about it.
They watch it every week. Like, they set aside time and they sit down. They have like a no phones rule. Like, you have to pay attention to the movie. And at first it's funny because Grown Ups 2 is such, I've never seen it, but I know so much about it now listening to them talk about it. And it's so weird because so much happens in that movie and it doesn't really have much of a threat, it doesn't seem like. And so they talk about it as if it's this alien thing where it's so funny the things they bring up. But then because they've gone over the plot so many times, they get into these existential discussions about what are we doing, or just what is life, or, you know, what is the meaning of this? They sometimes bring on guests, like they brought on a film critic, or they've just brought on friends. It's very informal, and it's a lot of fun. You know, you can just, you know, download the episodes. I'll listen to a few at a time and then jump ahead, but it's a good one.
Wow, that sounds like torture. Yeah. I mean, for them, not for...
Oh, for us, it's great.
I know, yeah. I've heard that a couple times, and I always thought, I gotta listen to that, and I haven't yet. I probably will now, though. Yeah, that sounds great. I gotta talk about Ken Bone, because...
Oh, that's good, because I was gonna talk about Ken Bone, but then I decided that, okay, that's good.
So yeah.
We can talk about
this
Ken
week
Bone.
In politics.
This Ken week Bone. In politics, you know, the debate Monday, frankly, I can say...
It was
as an American
Sunday.
Citizen, Sunday?
The debate was Sunday night.
Yeah, what day is it?
It's Wednesday.
Oh, wow, yeah. anyway, so the debate this week was terrifying. In a lot of ways, it was depressing, it was demoralizing, it was terrifying. And then Ken Bone,
the hero America needs, but not the hero America deserves.
Exactly. The man in the red sweater, and he's just like this perfect... commentary on how we can just to distract ourselves quasi ironically adopt this like figure,
and he's not a terrifying clown
out of nothing. He's just a guy who asked a question about energy,
and it was a good question, and he also seems like a genuine person, and I really hope that in my heart of hearts that he is not showing up on our TV in 3 years like as part of some horrible, you know, he's out on Dancing with the Stars or something. Like, I hope he just remains Ken Bone.
Yeah, just goes back to his life.
But
after
I,
this brief kind of brush with
yeah,
fame.
But I follow him on Twitter. He's Ken Bone 18.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He, some of his responses to people, he is so funny. Like, he's dry. He's a star. Really witty.
Well,
he's great.
Here's the thing about him is, you know, a lot of times we look at this and we're like, who is still undecided in this election? What reason could you have to be undecided between these two candidates? And his reasoning, I saw a little Washington Post video he did, and his reasoning is really good. He works in the fossil fuel industry, and he feels like the Republicans will, you know, ensure him job security, but he also feels like Hillary Clinton, you know, will probably be better for the greater good, in his opinion. And I'm like, I can understand that. He's kind of torn between his own job and, you know, what he thinks is best for the country at large. And it's just very human and very honest. It's not like he's some dumb guy who's like, I don't know what the answer
right.
is.
Right. And that sweater that he had, I feel like that is such a, that's such a sweater. It's like, I don't want to say it's a dad sweater. It's just, I mean, like every man I know has a sweater like that. Maybe not red, but it's definitely one of those zip up dealings.
Yeah. I just think it's so crazy that he was instantly, like, as soon as he got on stage, because it came after a pretty tense moment. I don't remember what the moment was, but they were yelling at each other for something. He gets up on stage, and Ben Smith, the editor of BuzzFeed, immediately tweets something like, Ken Bone and I are in love. And I knew from that moment that it was just going to be a whole internet thing, that Ken Bone was just going to be adopted into a meme. Like, for Christ's sake, he's the new Harambe. Like, step aside.
Oh, finally.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
finally.
Down with Harambe. Yeah. Harambe's such a mean.
I really meme. Think that, yeah. Well, Ken Bone is kind of a mean meme, too.
I don't think it's mean. I think there's a lot of genuine love for him.
There is. Yeah, you know what?
It comes
walking,
from an ironic place.
I was mentioning this to Richard the other day, that it's walking this really fine line between gently poking at him and being mean, because I think that, like, I saw Anil Dash tweeted something that he had a picture of Ken Bone with a microphone and asking some really nerdy Star Wars question, mm-hmm. and he got a little bit of pushback on that, and he was saying, wait, guys, remember, I am a huge nerd. He is one of us. Like, I'm not making fun of him, but I think that some of that is a little, there's a line.
I think it's just a little scary, too, when we really think about it. Like, this dude got up at a town hall meeting to talk, and suddenly, you know, he's blown up overnight. He mentions how he had, like, hundreds of Facebook friend requests because people just Googled him and found out information about him.
Right.
And just that this ordinary guy suddenly has been rocketed to fame where everybody knows him and we're talking about him out in Massachusetts.
And I don't want to know if Ken Bone does terrible things. Like, I just want him to be...
Yeah.
Just stay where you are.
Why can't he just be a guy who asks a question at a debate?
Right.
Like, that's
Someone
the
tweeted,
culture we have.
Right.
Now.
Someone tweeted, at the media, like, hey, don't y'all go and, like, find out anything about him and ruin this for us.
Yes, don't ruin this for us.
don't ruin this for us by finding out anything about him. But that's exactly what we've done.
Right.
Yeah.
National political reporters have tried and succeeded in interviewing Ken Bone on how he feels.
Right. Well, he also retweeted this guy named Phil Friend, who posted a Vine of Ken Bone after the debate that says game recognize game, and it's really awesome. It's Bill Clinton is shaking someone's hand, and then he looks over at Ken Bone and kind of points it, and he's like, you can tell Clinton saying something like, man, that was a great question, like, it's really nice to meet you, and comes with, like, he holds his hand out to shake Ken Bone's hand, and it was pretty cool.
But, you know, it really proves how right Andy Warhol was about the whole 15 minutes of fame in the future, right. And that this just is dude, just a normal, ordinary dude suddenly is nationally famous.
And I think that also, I think no matter what side of the aisle you're on, this election has been so long and it's so tiring. And if,
forever.
You know, I mean, we're journalists, of course, we're all news junkies, we're going to be watching it all the time, but even my friends who aren't journalists are on this all the time, and it's exhausting. You know, if I've had a chance to not look at my phone for a while, I don't, and it's nice. But I feel like Ken Bone was just everyone's like, thank God, there's something funny we can take out of
this.
It's
debate. Like we need
it was so horrible.
It's like Bread and Circus.
Yeah.
2016 Bread and Circus.
Exactly.
We just need something to distract us for a little bit from just the reality of where we
right.
are.
Yeah.
And it's upbeat, and like I said, it's not
right.
clowns or Harambe.
Yeah.
Oh, Ken Bone.
God, stop with the clowns, too. Please.
Oh, yeah. The clowns. I think the clowns are already done.
I think so. Just a PSA. If you're talking about the killer clowns or whatever, stop, please.
Yeah,
please. It's boring.
Yeah. I think this tweet, I retweeted it. It's from David Itzkoff, who I think is a New York Times writer. But it was so funny. It, like, perfectly sums up the way I feel about Ken Bones. It's, how do we let a TV entertainer come so close to the presidency? Asks a culture on its second day of celebrating a guy who wore a red sweater.
It's true. It's true.
We have the presidential race in many ways that we deserve.
Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Megan Kelly, Bill Shaner, and Brad Avery and is part of the Wicked Local Network. It was edited by Bill Shaner. Music is provided by Milford band Born Without Bones. Visit our website at MetroWestDailyNews.com and follow us on Twitter at MetroWestDaily. I don't show up.